Hey, Liel, how are you feeling about the fact that our live show at the JCC got canceled because of snow?
I am
Yeah, Liel is definitely going to be swearing this week, so you might want to send the kids out of the room. This has been a very sincere and necessary obscenity warning. Hello, Jews. This is Unorthodox, the world's leading Jewish podcast. I am your host, Mark Oppenheimer, joined this week by senior writer Liel Leibowitz.
Happy snow day to you.
Happy snow day to you and deputy editor Stephanie Button.
Happy snow day to everyone in the Northeast region and no one else.
We were supposed to be at the JCC of Manhattan.
Wait, we're not there right now?
We're not there. We are at Josh Cross's apartment where we are looking at, it's on the seventh floor of a beautiful building in Harlem. We're looking at the snowflakes falling outside. We are being served bagels and lox and whitefish and coffee.
There are 380 children.
There's a lot of children here. Around. That's pretty much why I'm here to hang out with the youngs.
360 are Marks.
Josh's son made me matcha earlier. Like, this is the best day of my life. I mean, obviously, we'd love to have done the live show, and we're sad, and we had people come in from out of town for it, and we feel really, really bad about it.
Yeah.
But I think we are making the most of... We're getting lemonade. What's the...
Lemonade is being made of the lemons.
Yeah.
Well, matcha tea is being made.
Yeah, so that's true.
That is the difference, by the way, from like New York City. Like in New York City, the 13-year-olds make matcha. In New Haven, there is not a 13-year-old in New Haven who knows what matcha is. And here they are like barista level.
Yeah.
You know, on mornings like this, New York is almost tolerable.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's snowy. There are lovely kids running around making exotic Asian drinks.
So I have to say, to producer Josh Cross, though, because the show got canceled, and within like a half an hour, we had a plan that basically is to come here the morning of the snow day, record at his kitchen table, disrupt his entire family's life, and we're all really appreciative.
And you got bagels on the way.
I brought bagels, yes.
You brought bagels.
I stopped at Absolute Bagels on 110.
The world's best.
And had to go back for cash because they only take cash.
They do.
That's right. Yeah. I've been
Worth
burned
it.
That way.
Worth
I've been,
it.
I've gotten to the front of that line to find out that they only take cash. So we have three Cross children here, two Leibowitz Sandel children.
Leibovai.
One Oppenheimer child. It's amazing what's going on
it's
here.
It's weird that like cats weren't invited here. I feel a little bit targeted.
A little othered.
I'm jealous of like the fun playing that's going on in the other room. Do you hear the sound of children just like... laughing
and at one point playing a recorder. Yeah, this is going to be a sonically interesting show for our listeners. Our Gentile of the week, by the way, is Bart Campolo, former evangelical preacher turned humanist chaplain. Jew of the week at the JCC was going to be Joe Lieberman, but when snow messed with our plans, it also messed with Lieberman's plans, and so we will
Senator Lieberman is home praying fervently to God to halt the storm.
And the funny thing is, Bart Campolo is here for the show, so we actually have him indefinitely.
Because he snowed in, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, we'll be recording with him until his plane takes off in 16 days.
He may be the fourth host of Unorthodox, actually, by the time this is over.
You think, by the way, that if Joe Lieberman raises both of his arms, the snow continues, and if he puts them down, the snow stops.
We had so many fun questions we were going to ask him tonight at the live
show.
We'll
have him back at a later date.
Yes, we will.
At a later date. But the thing is, when you have Bart Campolo, you don't need Joe Lieberman in all sorts of ways. Like, in a sense, we lost our Orthodox guy and we got our unorthodox guy. And so we will...
So this week we're going really unorthodox.
We're going really unorthodox.
Full blown.
However, that said, religion is always with us. There's a holiday coming up, I've heard. I've heard it's called Passover. Leo, what are we doing for Passover?
Well, a different way of asking this question is, how is this Seder different
from
than
all
other Seders? Yeah. Because this year, around the Seder table, all of us, and all of you out there will be enjoying...
The Unorthodox Haggadah.
Ooh. The Unorthodox Haggadah, which went to print this morning. And by print, I mean went to the designer who would put it in a beautiful PDF form, which will be delivered Tuesday, the 27th.
I don't keep time anymore.
At 10 a.m. To homes.
And what will it cost people who want to use it?
It would cost people goodwill, a smile, a bit of gratitude, and nothing else.
And so if they can if they know how to download a PDF.
Yeah, you know what they say, if you PDF it.
It will come.
It is no dream.
I think the exciting, I mean, look, we've heard from people who are like, I'm interested. I need to know a little bit more before I commit to this being my Haggadah.
So then let's talk about that.
Let's give them a little bit. I mean, this is our best, like, what's HSN, like Home Shopping Network thing.
Dial now and we'll throw in some Maror.
Yeah. So, okay. So what is this Haggadah? This Haggadah, first of all, it keeps pretty much everything that matters from a typical
it's Haggadah. Very intense. Let's say Liel really spearheaded this project. Yeah, and like, I didn't even believe it was going to happen because he's like, let's make a Haggadah in 2 weeks.
So this Haggadah is really for everyone, but here is who I think will enjoy it. If you're the kind of person who really doesn't want to be bothered and you want the 2-minute version app, this is not the Haggadah for you.
Right. There is like a 30-second or 3-minute Haggadah you can download online. It's not that Haggadah.
It's not that Haggadah.
No.
If you are not but Orthodox and every single word and you know, sermon and ceremony and ritual matters, and you look forward to the 7.5-hour gathering in which you tell stories from your favorite, you know, Gemara, that's also not the Haggadah for you.
I had a conversation a few years ago with my friend Nathan Jeanette, whose family are listeners to this show. And I remember he had been at some Seder where they'd gone till like, they hadn't even eaten till 11:30 at night or something. He was, and Nathan's like, he's a hardcore guy in all sorts of ways. He's a beautiful soul, but a hardcore guy in ways that I'm not. And he was so proud. He was like, we didn't even eat till 11:30. The Afikoman was not found till 3 a.m. And it was like, this was the essence of Seder for him.
We did not have leavened bread for 7 months.
That's right. So it's not that Haggadah.
We actually built a pyramid in the backyard. This is how hardcore Egypt we are.
Like, if you want to not be eating till 2 a.m, it's not that Haggadah.
But
it's in the middle somewhere.
If you would like a serious, respectful Haggadah that keeps, say, 90% of the original text in Hebrew, English, and transliterated Hebrew, that features contributions from some of your favorite podcast hosts and guests, and more about that in a minute.
Yep.
That has good little questions that you could ask your family members and your friends sitting around the table.
Yep.
This is,
and it also has a lot of fun.
It does.
Like, I mean, I just want to highlight the part where you sort of say, okay, we know what the 10 plagues in ancient Egypt were. If there were 10 plagues today, what would they be?
This question of, Stephanie?
Who else but Simon Doonan, former guest, and yes. Jonathan Adler, who are just like this amazing pair. And they're we're not going to say what they are, but they are very spot on.
Can I say one?
Yeah.
I want to give people a taste of one of them is those Mylar birthday balloons.
Like, and it's true.
I was like, yeah, that's totally true. That is a contemporary plague.
I love them, but they're everywhere now.
Yeah. We, for example, asked the writer and former great guest, Daphne Merkin, to contribute an essay on the Seder as therapy. Which is completely, you know, smack in her circle of interest, which was lovely.
We got Tova Mervis to write about the Wicked Child.
We have 4 daughters riffing on the 4 sons, including this year, Stephanie Butnick.
Mm-hmm. I am the simple child.
And it's a kind of Haggadah that if you want to gather around a table with your family and friends, assume that everyone has different levels of knowledge. Everyone has different levels of comfort with the text and the ritual. Everyone comes from their own, you know, background. But you want to have an evening that is meaningful, that is fun, that is unorthodox, that feels like your favorite podcast. This is the Haggadah for you. Mark, again, how much does it cost?
I think it costs all of nothing, plus 15% tax.
0 shekels.
Yeah, it's 1.15.
And I mean, the funny thing is, it's a PDF. So basically, you can sign up. The way you're gonna get it is you sign up, you give us your email, and we'll send it to you. You also might be subscribed to our newsletter, just because we assume that you would like that. But you can actually put the emails in of everyone who's coming to your Seder and get it emailed to them. Like, to me, that is like first class service.
In advance, and then you could read it on your phone,
look,
on your
tablet. You can print it. Everyone's on their phone anyway. We may as well just actually like use them for good.
Mm-hmm. It is up to you how you consume
or
this beautiful thing. It will also be beautifully
designed. The design is extraordinary. And I think there are a lot of, like, I like the Maxwell House Haggadah, for example, but it's not a beautiful document. And this is going to be, like, we really went...
a real beaut.
It's a classy, it's a class act.
I would say since the tablets... There probably hasn't been that much attention, you know, into designing a Jewish text.
So that's what's going on in Liel's life, is he really has spearheaded this. He's quarterbacked it. I'm looking for another cliche. He's worn this hat. He's run with it. Stephanie, what's been going on?
He's taking it to the next level.
He's in the next level. He's been going 25-8.
There's an amazing article in McSweeney's in which just this writer just basically said, I'm going to close this deal based solely on things that I heard business people at airports shouting into their cell phones. He's like, Steve, this is in our wheelhouse, man.
I like to wear this. I like to take off one hat and put on my other hat.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. What's going on with you, Stephanie?
I don't got that much going on, to be honest. The snow day is like, it's everything's just different, but except for my cat, everything is exactly the same for him. He's just like, why are you here? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, right, I don't want to be here with you.
How is this morning different than all other
mornings?
Why are you here?
I have two bits of Oppenheimeriana.
I feel like I need a trigger warning for how much news you're about to drop right now.
Well, one is very simple, which is since I last saw you, I had not shaved. I've had 6 or 7 days of growth going. And my kids' level of hostility is so great. At one point, I mean, it was Lysistrata. They got together and said, there will be no hugs. There will be no physical affection until you shave. And we hate you. It was like, we hate you and won't touch you till you shave.
P.S. We hate you.
Right. I mean, and Sid supports this all because she thinks my beard is fairly white, so she thinks it ages me. And
your
I just
beard
thought,
is white. Interesting.
The goatee part. I mean, the goatee part is white.
Here.
Yeah, like Liel.
Yeah, I think this is a good like division of labor between us. You're the youthful, fine, shaved one. And I'm the somber, rabbinic, heavy set bearded.
Right. So I shaved yesterday. That was like a surprise.
Did you use a Harry's razor?
I am the first to be targeted in the pogrom. You're the second to be targeted in the pogrom.
But that was a surprising amount of the psychic energy. It was a surprising amount of the vibe at Oppenheim.
They're like, and you're bringing us another one of you with your beards.
I mean, that's always in the background these days, is the hostility around Oppenheimer. But the hilarious thing around Oppenheimer is I discovered, as I've never discovered before, although Liel might have learned this with Hudson, is that when you tell people you're having a son, everyone has a favorite moil to recommend. People are really loyal to their moils.
Loyal.
They're moil loyal. And
there's a moilty card.
I kid you not, half a dozen people have said to me, oh, a son? Do I have a moil for you? And I mean, one friend of mine from the listenership, but saw someone I'm friendly with, who I didn't know was a moil, sent me his rates, basically.
And his headshot.
Like, you know, his YouTube reel.
Well, headshot for moil means something completely different. I'm so sorry. I'm really sorry.
Oh, God.
He sent me his sizzle reel.
Snow day.
As actors say, his sizzle reel. But I mean, it is so funny to me that people, it's like you know the way everyone wants you to use their auto mechanic? They want me to use their moil.
I think there's
nothing more Jewish than like wanting everyone to use the guy you use.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It was right. Like I got a guy.
It's a great moment to say Dr. Dorothy. What's her name, Lisa?
Oh yeah.
Green. Dr. Dorothy Greenbaum.
She was your mohelet.
She was amazing. She's a doctor. I mean, she really.
A doctor, a moil, and a grandma.
And like no jokes.
Nope.
Very like
no shtick.
Yeah.
No.
Like I don't like wedding rabbi or moil with shtick.
That's right.
No shticky moils. No. That's a whole other thing. All right, let's get to the news of the Jews.
Of other Jews.
Before we get to the good stuff, which is all American this week, and it's good. The news of the Jews this week is outstanding. I want to just click through two Israel stories because they're both important to Israel. The first is that Spotify is coming to Israel.
Correct.
Liel, is this important in any way?
Not even a little bit.
Okay, never mind.
It'll be, you know, 5 million people listening to Shlomo Artzi.
There we go.
A nonstop repeat.
I'm surprised Spotify is not one of those things that started in Israel.
In Israel.
Like every
ways.
Single other app in the entire universe.
Right. Yeah. Well, they're getting it now. The other Israel story is that Elon Musk is there. And apparently he like took a selfie at Masada or something.
Yeah, that requisite Masada selfie. He's like, here, from here is where we'll blast our next rocket.
Yeah, I have to say, when Elon Musk travels places, I get a little worried. I was like, why are you here and what do you want to do
and
to my
country?
Why are
you going to this hilltop thing?
Because you're not just there like, oh, beautiful, historical. It'd be like, yeah, from here, we could probably...
He's like, it's flat at the top of Masada. We could do the launch.
Spaceships. Like, dude, no.
Okay, moving eastwards across the globe for News of the Jews, we land in Scotland. Some of you might remember that story of the Scottish guy who trained his girlfriend's dog. It was his girlfriend's dog, right?
His whole thing was, we talked about it when it happened. His girlfriend was always saying how cute her dog was. It's like this little pug. And he's like, you know what's not cute? A dog giving a Nazi salute. So he trained the dog to give a Nazi salute.
Yeah.
He would say like, Heil Hitler, and he would do it. And then he would also say, gas the Jews, and he would do it. So it's like, why did you have to say gas the Jews?
No, because that's the next level. It's not just that the dog is a real Nazi. It's not just he responds to the Fuhrer. He responds to like
Just basic. And he's like,
that's right.
But as far as we know, this guy is not himself an anti-Semite. He's just someone with a very unfortunate sense of humor, right?
He was just like charged with a hate crime.
And so that's the news. The news of the Jews is that this week he was found guilty of a hate crime. Whom has he perpetrated a crime against? I'm sorry, the Jewish people. I'm on this guy's side.
And Frank.
I frankly think you should be able to trade your domestic pets to respond to any calls you want. It is not a matter for the state if your dog is
Mark,
a Nazi.
Mark, it begins with a dog giving a Nazi salute. Next thing you know, the dog is like rallying people up to the trains, and then the dog sits, you know, in a glass cage in Jerusalem, being like, "I was only following orders." Like literally,
okay,
sis, stay, exterminate. Like
a few important details.
Dog.
The dog is named Buddha.
Buddha, it's a
which
pug.
I feel like is just like you're making your dog's named Buddha, and you're making it give Nazi salutes, like mixed messages left and right.
Well, this the guy hates his girlfriend. This is clearly. I mean, I want to know if he and the girlfriend are still together.
And so basically,
if Ben changed your cat to respond to give Sig Heil, so what would that do to your marriage?
I mean. That would just be like trolling on another level.
In his defense, the dog said, "Well, my name is Buddha, and the swastika is an ancient Buddhist symbol."
Ancient Aryan symbol, right?
I'm just trying to take it back.
Okay, moving farther east to the peak news of the Jews this week. Many of you know this story already. This is zipped around Facebook. Okay, a DC lawmaker named Trayon White Sr. had to apologize for comments he made in a Facebook video about how the Jews control the Washington, D.C. weather. Okay, I'm just going to quote from what he said. He said, "Man, it just started snowing out of nowhere this morning, man. Y'all better pay attention to this climate control, this climate manipulation. And DC keeps talking about we are a resilient city, and that's a model based off the Rothschilds controlling the climate to create natural disasters they can pay for to own the cities, man. Be careful." Okay, so it's not a well thought out thought, but the nub of it seems to be that the Rothschild banking family worldwide conspiracy is controlling the
AKA
weather,
the Jews,
to create natural disasters to make the cities fall into their financial grasping claws or something. This may be the craziest story I've ever heard. So the funny thing was, he apologized really sincerely. I mean, his apology was the right kind of apology. He said, "Look, I've talked to a lot of friends about this. I've done some self-education. I've learned. I didn't think of the Rothschilds as being an anti-Semitic dog whistle." And you know what? That could be plausible, right? Like, who knows what this guy
I'm
knows
sorry.
Or doesn't
know. So
wait a second. Wait. But it's like, okay, so he's down. He's cool with the Jews. Like, fine, you've apologized, and I'm all about forgiveness, and I don't think people should have to resign and lose jobs or whatever. DC still has a city councilor who thinks that humans can control the weather.
Exactly right. Okay, so it wasn't the Jews. It was this random family who controls the weather.
It was the Unitarians.
Oh,
they control
Lord.
The weather.
To be honest, if you wanted proof that we don't control the weather, our freaking live show was canceled. So, like, we obviously don't. Unless it's a very clever ploy to make it appear as though we don't control the weather.
And Senator Joe Lieberman was like, "I do not wish to do this."
Our Gentile of the week is Bart Campolo, who after more than 30 years of Christian ministry became a humanist chaplain at the University of Cincinnati, which I think is a sort of a bridge version of your story, I imagine. And he now works with people who are looking to pursue goodness in an openly secular way. Welcome, Bart.
Well,
welcome,
thank
Bart.
You. Thank you all.
Welcome to the Upper Upper West Side.
I'm so happy to be with you on your snow day.
So we brought you here saying you're going to do a live show at the JCC in front of a couple hundred people, and instead you're having bagels in Josh's apartment
and
in Harlem.
I know, with Joe Lieberman, who I was so excited to meet, being old enough to remember Joe Lieberman.
And here we are.
Alas.
We lied. We don't just control the weather. Yeah. We just lie to people. It's just...
I do want to point out that when it started snowing and your JCC show got canceled, Mark wrote me a text and said, "I apologize for what's happening here."
Oh my God, you did it.
I outed us.
It's like a false flag,
I'm just
right?
Saying.
I outed us. I'm sorry.
So you have an amazing story that I imagine butchered in your introduction, but tell us like the shortened version of what
tell
your
us what
life
happened.
Yeah, like, what's your deal?
What happened to you?
What happened? What happened?
How did you get here?
That's what my father says all the time. What happened?
What happened?
Because I did. I grew up, it's funny, your listeners won't know my last name, but if a bunch of evangelical Christians anywhere in this country, my dad is a, like, evangelical Christian
like
royalty. Yes, like, he's a big deal.
Wow.
When Clinton was in office and got in trouble with Monica Lewinsky and he had, like, pastors coming to the White House weekly to pray with him and to work with him. My dad was one of those guys.
Wow.
Like he was a, you know, he's the guy who speaks to 10,000 people in a stadium somewhere. And so I grew up in that world, but I myself was never, didn't, grew up not believing in God. So it wasn't like I was a rebellious kid or hated my parents. I thought they believed in God. I thought they were sincere. It was just that the story never made sense to me until I was in high school. And when I was in high school, I got swept up by a friend of mine and brought along to an evangelical Christian youth group, like at a mega church.
And
like,
evangelicals do youth groups so well.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Like,
it's not like BBYO. They got it down.
They've got thing. Youth group down.
This was 300 kids, a rock and roll band, a laser light show, like, you know, like world-class gaming and all sorts of stuff going on. And I walked into that youth group and the weird thing about it was the most loving a group of kids other than the ones you have in the other room. It was just the most warm and loving group of young people I had ever been around. And
it was like non-bullying teenagers.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, I was a nice kid. I was a genuinely nice kid, kind of trying to make things better, like intervening in when people were getting bullied, like in some, you know, public service announcement ad. Like, I was that guy. And so I walk into this group.
And there's 300 like you and you're all there.
It seemed like a club for nice people I wanted to join. I just wanted to be a part of it. And when I figured out that they were all evangelical Christians, I still didn't believe in God, but I knew how to fake it because I had grown up in that world.
And were you like, do they know your last name? And they're like, oh man, Bart.
What's interesting is evangelical Christianity is segmented. And so the church that I got taken along to was a church that didn't think my dad was the greatest thing since sliced bread. He was a little too liberal for them, a little too social justice oriented. They were more Bible thumpers. And so, but I got in to this group and I just went along for a while. And then one day we were up on a retreat. And if you think we do youth group well, you should be on an evangelical Christian retreat.
My God.
And so it's Saturday night. There's light, candlelight, 300 kids swaying, going, I love you, Lord, and I lift my voice. And I felt something. I had a kind of a transcendent experience, you know? And it's funny because I hang around with a lot of those, well, I don't hang around them, but I know a lot of those hardcore angry atheist types, and they'll always be like, you must be so embarrassed that you that you pretended that you heard the voice of God. You must be so embarrassed that you said that you felt the Holy Spirit in your, and I was like, listen, I don't believe in God. There's not a supernatural bone in my body left, but I'm telling you, on that retreat, something happened. I felt something. I had a transcendent moment. And you know, I always say to my atheist friends, if you don't believe in transcendent moments, you haven't been to the right rock concert.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't had sex with the right partner.
You've never been in love. You've never
used the right drugs.
Cuddled a puppy, right? Yeah, you've never done shrooms.
These things are scientifically verifiable. Like you have these kind of moments where you feel connected to something bigger than yourself, where you feel like you're part of something that's going on. And in my experience, whatever narrative you're in, when you have that experience, it confirms that narrative. And so I think if I would have been in a mosque in Afghanistan, I would have thought like, Allah is real. You know, I think if I would have been in Sedona, I would have gone like, nature, man, it's amazing, the crystals. Like, but I was on an evangelical Christian retreat. And for me, that was God, that was Jesus. And so then I was really in. And for the and I won't tell you the whole story.
By the way, how proud was Dad?
Oh my gosh.
You come back Sunday afternoon and be like, Dad, we need to have a talk.
It's funny.
I'm coming out as an evangelical Christian.
A filmmaker just made a documentary about me and my dad called Leaving My Father's Faith. And it's kind of the story, the whole story of the arc of faith. And then how he and I are having a conversation through the whole thing. And he talks about what it was like for him when I came home from receiving Jesus as my personal Lord and Savior. And he was like, it was so exciting for me. It was like I was in the tribe. Like if you're Jewish, you're born into the tribe. If you're evangelical Christian, you believe into the tribe. And I believed into it.
Did he like pour you a scotch, give you the car keys? Was there any sort of reward for this?
Take you to this hooker he knew. He's like, you're a man now, son.
Stop. No. But what happened is that for him, and the next 30 years, like I got serious about this stuff. I mean, I was that guy who carried the Bible to high school and hoped you would persecute me. and the first thing anybody asked me to do for Jesus was to run a summer camp in Camden, New Jersey. And I saw urban poverty for the first time. You know, you're a nice kid. You believe in God. You're there on a mission for Jesus and you see this poverty. And that was it for me. I spent the next 30 years as an inner city missionary working with poor people. And again, like to keep the story really short, over the course of that time, like I'm working in ghettos with really poor people trying to do stuff. My commitment to loving relationships and community building and social justice and building, you know, and reaching out to people that are in need, that just grew and grew and grew. And my ability to believe in a supernatural God who actually does anything died the death of 1,000 cuts, 1,000 unanswered prayers. I mean, I was asking God to do really basic stuff, like stop that little girl from getting raped by her uncle every week. You know, help this lady with 5 kids not die of cancer. And the lady would die. And the girl would keep getting abused. And so over time, you know, sort of the supernatural, my ability to believe in a God who does anything died slowly. But I was, I kept changing my theology all the way through because I wanted to stay in because I love that community. So for instance, that summer in Camden, I decided that I had thought that God was sovereign in the sense of like, he would get you a parking place if you needed one. While Jews couldn't change the weather, God actually could. So you would pray for good weather for your cousin's wedding, right? But that summer I realized that like, if God was actually in control of everything that was happening, he was an awful, awful person. And so I decided that God was only able to work in the world through those people who surrendered their will to him. And that's what it meant to be a Christian, was to surrender your will and allow God to use you to do his work in the world. And so like you change your theology. Same thing when I went to college and I had gay roommates. Like I knew what, this was the 80s, evangelical Christian. I knew what we thought about gay people. I knew what the Bible thought. I knew what God thought about gay people. But like you're there and you know these guys and they become your friends. And so all of a sudden, like, I changed my theology again. Those verses were not the right ones. Like the Bible was wrong about that particular subject. And so all the way through, I kept, instead of getting angry at God, I kept changing God to be a God I could like. I mean, the last God I believed in before I gave it all up was the most awesome and wonderful God you could imagine. You would have loved that God. He was just like me.
That's my God, actually. I know that dude.
Yes, exactly.
He is awesome.
Yeah, agrees with everything.
He's like pro-gay.
Yes.
He's a Democrat.
He loves your kids.
He loves my kids. He's infinitely patient with my kids.
He's the God of Netflix and chill.
Totally. Yeah. He's into dogs, but cats, you know, he's right. My God.
God hates cats, that's for sure.
But the difficulty is when you're a Jew, that's a big joke. Like you can laugh about that because you don't need to believe in God in order to stay in the tribe. When you're an evangelical Christian, it's devastating.
So was there anyone you could tell this to when it was going on, or are you just having this like internal intense battle?
That's the funny thing about me is by this time I'm a public Christian. Like I'm a guy who preaches sermons in places. And the weird thing about me was, and this is my parents raised me in a way to believe that it was okay to be whatever I was. Like, I mean, and it's funny, my dad grew up in a Jewish neighborhood in West Philadelphia. And he always used to say like that the difference between his mother and the Jewish mothers is when they would leave the house in the morning, his mother would say, "Tony, do you have your lunch?" And the other kids' mothers would say, you know, "Joey, do you have your books?" But he
well, because she knew they had their lunch. Right, exactly.
But he incorporated or inculcated in this idea of like, if I came home having failed a test, he would say, "I don't know what's wrong with those teachers at the school. They don't know how to teach a genius." Like the idea was like, there was nothing wrong with me. I was fine all the way through. And so even as an older person, when I started going through these changes, it never occurred to me not to say them out loud. And so, you know, kind of publicly in my Christian career, I passed through every stage of heresy on my way to apostasy. And so when I finally came out, I had a bike crash and almost died and had a head injury. And when I was okay, I said to my wife, like, "Look, this life is short. I'm going to die. When I die, I won't exist anymore. I think this is all we get." And she said, "I think you're right. And I think you better stop being a professional Christian because you don't believe any of it anymore."
Could you stop right there for a second and talk about, like, marriages are tricky things that way, right? And you pretty much, for it to work, it's helpful if you're walking along a path together. Did you know that she'd been having doubts? Had you guys been in lockstep?
Well, yes. And in answer to Stephanie's question, we say, like, could you talk to anybody? I talked to my wife, but I also talked from pulpits. Like when I became a universalist who believed God saved everybody, I preached that. And I got thrown out of half the churches I spoke at. When I started doing gay weddings, Everyone knew that. And like, I got thrown out of another set of churches. And so by the time I finally came, when I had that bike accident, when I finally came out, my wife says, look, we know where you are, but like, you got to stop. Like, you're preaching in this narrow intersection between you and the community, like the stuff you agree on, like we should love poor people. She's like, you gotta be done with this group altogether. When I finally told people, hey, I don't believe in God anymore, the reaction among all my closest friends were, yeah, we knew that. It was like coming out gay. Yeah, they're like, we knew. We wondered when you'd figure it out. Yeah. And so, you know, people often say, like, how many people did you lose? Did you lose all your friends and family? Because I know a lot of people, Mark, who've even lost their marriages.
Of course.
Because they didn't tell their wife or their husband what was going on. And finally, they come to this place where, like, I don't believe any of it. And their spouse is like, I still believe all of it. And it's a huge culture clash for the family. And if they have kids, it's devastating. Like, what do we teach the kids? Because if you don't believe in evangelical Christianity, to teach your kids that they are originally sinful, that they are utterly depraved and deserving of hellfire outside of the grace of Jesus Christ, that's child abuse, right? But if you are an evangelical Christian and there is a God, then that's just salvation teaching. Like, you're immunizing your kids against the worst thing that could happen to them, which is to burn in hell forever.
Now, at any point did your father or anyone else say, okay, look, you worked it out. It took a long time. You got awesome God. You got to awesome God, the God that you loved. Why don't you take a while? There may be some more changes. You may fall back in love. It's just a step in your relationship. You know, maybe you and God go on a nice weekend in Paris, spend some time together.
Yeah. I remember my dad saying to me, look, why can't you just be one of those John Shelby Spong, ultra-liberal, progressive Christians? They don't believe in God either, but they use the language. And in our popular culture, there's guys like Rob Bell, and my friend Mike McCarg and other people that they're Christians. But then when you like try to get at the, like, do you believe in the bodily resurrection? Do you believe that the Bible is the word of God? Do you believe that there's heaven after we die? They're like, it's all about mystery.
You never get a literal claim.
No. Yeah. And the thing is, like, I know what they're doing, and there's something good about it because they're making Christianity safe for a bunch of people that are stuck there. But there's also something not so good about it in the sense of when there are people for whom all that stuff is triggering, and all that stuff is associated with pain and oppression and difficulty. Or there are people that are like, when you say the word God, they don't know you mean universe. They think you mean actual person who does stuff and gave my wife cancer and didn't heal her of it. Like, sometimes I think, like, if you don't believe in any of that stuff anymore, it might just be better to say, I'm secular.
Can you say something about that letter you got after we and I first met and I wrote that piece about you? You got a letter from someone. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Oh, I think I do. Yeah.
And maybe we can go down this road, and then if you feel like blowing his cover, we could.
No, it won't blow his cover. I mean, I get these letters all the time.
If I'm not mistaken, he said, you know, you'd given a real, back when you were more Christian, earlier in your career, you'd given some talk at a college and made him feel, and your preaching with all the love you had made him feel terrible about the fact that he masturbated, was it that he was gay?
Here's the thing, like, yeah, in our cult, in that world, like, I was a virgin when I got married and felt guilty about masturbating, when I was 16 years old. Like, and I could tell you horror stories about like cutting my wrist because, you know, on the back of my wrist, every time I would fail, because there's a Bible verse that says that it would be better for you to cut off your hand or gouge out your eye than to let them cause you to sin. And so I was trying to discipline myself into not.
That is like some heavy shit.
Oh God. Yeah.
To use theological language.
Yeah. And can you, I mean, I'm a 15-year-old kid. I'm on the varsity soccer team. Like, And I had to shut that stuff down completely. And I know so many people that even after they got married, they're just racked with hangups. Like, sex is wrong, or sex is dirty, or you shouldn't be thinking. It wasn't just that I wasn't allowed to do it. I wasn't supposed to be thinking about it. If you lust after a woman in your heart, you've committed adultery in that world.
And this is despite the fact that God sent his prophet, his only daughter, Dr. Ruth, to teach the gospel. Just saying.
So for me, I thought I was super liberal, like that letter guy. I thought I was super liberal because I would talk to kids at youth rallies and say, hey, masturbation is not the unforgivable sin here. Like I said, but you know, if you want to grow in your sexuality and if you want to like think the right thoughts, you have to be open with other people. You have to be accountable. So like I used to tell the story about how my friends and I sort of confessed to each other. We were all struggling with pornography and masturbation. And then we would try to hold each other accountable. Now in my world back then, that was really open. Like I was saying the word masturbation out loud. And I was admitting that this was a problem for us. But the underlying message I was sending was talk to your friends together. Like AA, you will be able to help each other overcome your lust and sin problem. Well, this kid heard me. And he wrote to me 20 years later when he finds out that I'm the secular humanist chaplain at that time at USC out in California. And he said, yeah, real great for you that you've given up Jesus. He said, I spent 20 years totally fucked up, hating myself because, you know, and he said, I still remember this sermon. And he said, it was all bullshit. And you said it. And so like, now you're out, but what about all the people you hurt? What about all the people who you taught stuff? And I had to write back and say, I'm so sorry. The thing is, like, I really believed it. Like, I thought I was doing the right thing. But it's incredibly painful when you're post-Christian to realize, like, I taught people all sorts of things that probably have oppressed and wrecked them over time. And, you know, I feel terrible. And I did it all with a good heart. You know, I did it all, right, like, wanting to love them. So it's very, so when you're married to somebody and they're still in that world and you're not in that world, because that world makes total sense from the inside. But when you step out of it, it looks crazy. I mean, that Sam Harris once said, to, you know, when he was writing his letter to a Christian nation, he's like, what the Christians need to understand is when they look at Islam and go like, come on, you really think Muhammad flew on a flying horse? Like when you see the craziness of other people's narratives, he's like, that's how I see yours. That's how yours looks like from the outside. Everybody's narrative makes sense from the inside, but from the outside, they all look insane. And so when you're married to somebody and the narrative's that way, it's really hard on the secular person kind of dealing with the narrative of their believing spouse, but it's also really hard for the believing spouse because the secular person now represents an existential threat.
And so was the process of becoming, as you put it, post-Christian, was that also a process, or was it literally just waking up one morning being like, I'm done?
No, like I said, like it was a 30-year process.
No, but I know, but the moment you had the realization, were there still some hangups, some things you still did?
The realization ultimately wasn't a moment.
This is like in Spies Like Us where the guy dies, like, but the very end, but the very, or was, yeah, it Fletch? Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah. He's like, yeah. The very, very end was, yeah, sudden. He went suddenly. Well, the very, very, he was dying, yeah, for years, but the very, very end.
That moment, yeah.
The very, very end was, yeah, sudden.
I mean, the truth of the matter is that the very end wasn't deciding I didn't believe in God. The very end was realizing that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life pretending that I did.
Right.
You know, so there was nothing left for a long time, but I didn't do the math to connect that with the rest of my life and the stuff I was doing. Like, and so the bike crash was this thing where I was like, oh, you're going to die really soon. What do you want to do with the rest of your life? And what should you do with the rest of your life? And I became, you know, I became really convinced that what I needed to do was to try to create communities and opportunities for people to have all those wonderful things that they get out of being Jewish or they get out of being evangelical Christian, to feel like you're part of a tribe, a bunch of people that are committed to making the world a better place together, that you have some rituals, that you get together, that you help each other raise each other's kids, all those things. Like people who leave religious communities oftentimes find themselves alone in a very, very kind of cold world. And they can't find the other people that want to pursue goodness in a secular way.
So you don't feel any resentment towards people who still are believers? You don't feel any kind of—
I didn't get hurt. Like, the church was good to me. Like, all the Christians I hung out with were wonderful. We were feeding poor children in Camden, New Jersey. Like I was with the best possible Christians. Even my parents went, when I told them I didn't believe in God, I knew they were going to be hurt and disappointed. It never occurred to me that they would reject me. Like that would, that like, or that they would go, oh, Bart's going to burn in hell forever now. I mean, by the time I left Christianity, my parents had shifted their theology to like the kind of God they believe in doesn't send people to hell for having the wrong theology. And so, no, like I got friends. I got gay friends. I got friends I got women friends who were oppressed, who were given bizarre, crazy messages that wrecked their life and that haunt them to this day. They're angry. They're pissed.
With their traditions.
Yeah, they're angry with their positions. They're angry with the people that taught it to them. They're angry with their parents. And they're like the theology itself, the core narrative of Christianity, they want to destroy it. Whereas like for me, I don't have that kind of visceral anger towards it. But the other thing is, even if I thought that the Christian narrative was really toxic, which in many ways I think it is, the way to attack it directly just is going to cause everybody to double down on it. When you attack somebody's belief system directly, it's not just not unkind, it's bad strategy.
So let me ask you a crazy question. What is your theology like right now? And I use this word judiciously. You know, what do you believe about the source of good in the world? What do you believe about sin? Where are you now? I know it's a really weird...
No, it's very simple. Like, what you're kind of asking is like, what's your big narrative?
Yeah.
In a sense.
Like, you know, all religions...
What's your big narrative?
Yeah, all religions have two parts, right? They've got the big narrative, this is how the universe works, and they've got their like little narrative that says, and because the universe is this way, you should act this way, and don't eat
don't
that.
Eat pork.
Exactly, right. Yeah, you should know
and
that better than anyone.
Conclusion, here's a matzah. Yeah.
In conclusion, Mormon underwear. Yeah.
And so for me, what my sense is that at some, you know, like science takes me back almost to the beginning, you know, like to like 1 millisecond after the Big Bang. I got no idea what happened before that. I got no idea. But there's a story of like the matter and energy sort of coming into existence and then planets forming and, you know, all gravity and all these things emerging. And ultimately at some point, a single celled organism emerges. And I don't know how. I can't tell that part of the story. But again, once you get to that part of the story, then there's this epic of evolution. And it's this amazing story of life becoming more complicated and complex until you get to consciousness and then you get to human beings. And at some point when you have sentient human beings or sentient animals and they're relating to each other, at some point somebody's evolutionary strategy becomes cooperating, becomes connecting, becomes living collectively, like in a tribe, like a wolf pack or something. And wherever you have animals living socially, a code emerges. A sense of what's right and wrong. And it's not what's good for you or what's good for me. It's what's good for the group. And out of that basic code emerges morals. And they're different in different places depending on the circumstances, but a lot of things they have in common. And what they all have in common is they're all aimed at propagating life, moving life forward.
It also changes, isn't it? I mean, isn't there also an evolutionary component of it in which, you know, strongest members of the species survive? The different conditions and climates change.
The best adapted survive. And what you know, if you study natural selection, what naturally selects depends on the circumstances. And I think one of the really interesting things is like love, joy, peace, patience, kindness. On some level, those are really good adaptive strategies. Like the animals that cooperate best, that forgive the best, that love their children the best, they do really well. And so on some level, I'm a believer that life is amazingly wonderful. And I feel really grateful to be a sentient human being. And so for me, like you say, like, what do you believe about, like, what are you committed to? I'm committed to life and not just my life. Like, I love the whole thing. And what's right is the stuff that enables people to live and to flourish. And what's wrong is the stuff that keeps them from doing so.
So you've called yourself a post-Christian. You work as a humanist chaplain. Like, what does that mean?
By the way, I'm hating this interview so far just because you guys were so clever and pithy and cool with each other. And then, like, I get on and I give long conversations where I sound like a heavy sermonizing.
But like,
your mom gave you lunch. Our moms gave us books.
I know, it's bad.
But, like, what does that mean to someone who has never heard humanists? Like,
yeah, what are the holidays
what
like?
What are you now, basically? Tell us, like, put yourself in a different box for us to understand you.
Okay, like, bottom line is, like, if you said to me, like...
And what's the work you do?
Yeah, and they kind of fit together. Like, the bottom line is this. Like, I came to a basic conclusion, and that is that I'm a finite human being who's going to die, right? And my conclusion is, like, this life is this precious, brief moment. And Mike, so my initial question, as soon as I realized like this is it, it's like, how do I make the most of it? And if you don't have to do much research to start to learn that like the way to make the most of it isn't to make the most money. It isn't to like become the most powerful. It isn't to like have sex with the most partners. Like people try those strategies, but like the data would suggest that the people that end up feeling the best about their lives, that end up dying with the greatest level of satisfaction, that live the longest and flourish the most, are always those that have a handful of loving relationships and that do work that they feel like makes things better for others and cultivate a sense of gratitude for the privilege of being able to be a participant in the first place. And so if you say to me, what's a humanist? A humanist for me is somebody who goes like, I think the way to make the most of my life is to pursue loving relationships and to try to figure out how to do work that makes things better for other people and to cultivate a sense of gratitude and wonder, and who's smart enough to realize like, you know what? I don't think I can do that very well by myself. Like I believe in exercise too, but I don't do it unless I'm on a team or I'm part of a gym.
Like, or you're like paid to sign up for a class.
And yeah,
like you're
exactly. Exactly.
After 5 p.m.
We do these things collectively. Right. And so if I want to pursue goodness, the smartest thing I can do is to find a bunch of other people who want to pursue goodness and go like, let's pursue it together. And so for me, humanism is simply, it's like, you know, people say like, you know, aren't you against religion? I'm like, no, I'm not against religion. I'm trying to invent one. A religion is when a group of people collectively get together to try to answer life's ultimate questions.
And so what are holidays like? Humanist holidays?
Well, what's interesting is you go, like, what is a humanist holiday? That's a great question. And like, in the beginning, I couldn't think of any. And then, you know, I was like, well, Darwin's birthday. Like Darwin.
That's awesome.
Darwin was somebody who kind of started its.
It's Yud-Zayin in Tammuz, of course.
it's early in February. And
we need a holiday around then anyway. It's bleak.
And so we do. We celebrate. Like my students and I, we celebrate that because that was the beginning of a way of knowing, a way of thinking about life that really transformed a lot of people. So that's a good one. Sometimes people will celebrate the winter solstice and they'll go like, on the darkest day of the year, we celebrate that we found fire and that we figured out how to light up the world and that we figured out how to be warm and together when we're cold. Like, it's like.
But solstice people are just like two clicks from anti-vaxxers.
So I don't go there.
let's be honest about solstice people. But they're like two clicks from like naturopathy.
You guys, today is the spring equinox or yesterday.
Right. And so I don't, I'm not a new agey guy like that.
That's why we have you this week.
But you go like, Christmas? You go like, you know, when I was a Christian, we were always complaining, like, they've taken the Christ out of Christmas, you know, and stuff. All it is now, it's just a family holiday. It's just when people get together with the families. I'm like, good enough for me. Like Thanksgiving.
And maybe on Christmas, they celebrate the birth of a great teacher who lived and died. Like
Thanksgiving is my Sermon on the Mount. Favorite holiday of them all. Yeah. What, like the idea of a holiday dedicated
to Thanksgiving.
Being grateful for what we have.
Except for all like the bad stuff at the beginning of Thanksgiving.
But we can take it back, right?
We as like...
Wait a second. We all celebrate Thanksgiving.
No,
here.
I
Who
know,
are we
but
kidding?
Isn't Thanksgiving a little problematic because of like the
well,
pilgrims?
Well, it is if you're wearing pilgrim hats and stuff like that. But like if you're just
things.
Like, hey, this is the day when everybody flies home from college to be together.
To hook up with their high school significant
other. Because when you said the problem things at the beginning, I thought the Macy's Day Parade.
The floats are just offensive. So you work at a college.
Wait,
and so
does that make...
No, it makes total sense to me.
I
want
to know if I answered your question. Like humanism is simply like secular. Like I used to call myself a secular humanist, but like secular doesn't tell you anything except that I don't believe in any kind of supernatural woo-woo. The humanist part says, I'm committed to values. I'm committed to this species. I'm committed to the human experience. And the human experience is living and dying and loving and having sex and all of these things. And like, I want to live my life in such a way as to make the most of those experiences, but also to make it possible for other people to experience those things.
Yeah, so I mean, it's fascinating. And so on college campuses, like you're at the University of Cincinnati now, are there college students who identify as humanists now? Or do they sort of,
how,
I can't
how
imagine being
Jews?
So fully formed as an 18-year-old, basically.
That's a good question.
Right. Or like, are their parents humanists? I mean, like, who are the people that you are serving
most of
on
them,
campuses?
Most of them don't know they're a humanist unless I tell them that.
Uh-huh.
What I do is we put out, like, this would be a typical thing. Like, we put out a table that says USC or UC Secular Student Fellowship. And kids walk up and they go like, what's that? And you go like, well, you know, youth group is where people pursue goodness on the basis of the Bible, or a Hillel is where people are pursuing goodness on the basis of Jewish identity. This is for people that are pursuing goodness on the basis of common sense, science and reason, like just without God, without any supernaturalism. And the kid goes, wait, so this is for people who want to be good people, but don't believe in God. I'm like, yeah. And they're like, that's me. And they sign up. And so the idea is then you create a group. And Mark, you're saying like Protestants do youth group really well. I was a Protestant youth pastor. So I run the secular student fellowship like a really good Protestant youth group. Like you say, do you guys play games and eat potluck meals? And do you have like questions on the table to spark conversation? And do you give a little 10-minute sermon? Absolutely. It's a youth group for people who want to pursue goodness without God.
This reminds me of one of my favorite Jewish jokes. It's this Jewish man wakes up on a Saturday morning, says to his wife, I don't want to go to synagogue today. And the wife says, how come? And he says, well, you know, I hate the sermons. I hate the congregation. I don't really believe in God. And the wife says, well, I'm sorry, dear. You have to go because A, that's what we do in this household, and B, you're the rabbi.
Oh, damn.
Well, that actually gets to the question. I know you also have a counseling practice.
Yeah.
And my recollection is, when we talked about this before, that a lot of the people who reached out to you were people who were trying to transition out. The people who tell me if I'm wrong, who turn to you more for coaching and counseling aren't people who are just looking for goodness, but often people who are in flight from, they've been the rabbi, the minister, and they're trying to figure out, how do I do what you did? How do I leave? Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. What started out was, I started out with a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Humanize Me. And I simply talk, I have guests, we talk about, I have people from all different walks of life, and we talk about what they're learning. And my question is always, how can we apply that to building better relationships, making the world better for other people, and cultivating a sense of wonder? So whether it's a biologist or an animal rights activist or a carpenter, we're going to talk about like, what are they learning in their work and how do we apply that to becoming more human? Well, what happened, Mark, was like, I'm asking you because you asked the question, but like what happened was people started sending emails saying, could I talk to you? And the thing they most wanted to talk about was, I've transitioned away, like I've lost my faith in God, and I'm full of despair, and I can't find any meaning. And I thought I was going to go to heaven, and now if we're all just going to die in the end, what's the point of any of it? And so I ended up in the Skyping with these people, one-on-one, talking about life and having them read things and then talking about them and asking questions. And then an increasing number of people started coming saying, I'm where you're at, but my wife or my husband is the other place. How do we work that through? And so you ended up doing a lot of relational counseling.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you actually do a lot of the same stuff that you used to do, just at like a sort of tilted angle. So if you were back in Camden, New Jersey now, what would the difference be in, like, what would the day-to-day difference on the ground look like?
You know, my message, I used to see a kid stealing drugs on the corner. And I would, basically my message to that kid would be like, hey, I got a better life for you than this. Like, come over here where my friends are. Like, we'll love you and we'll find something better for you to do. And in this context, you'll experience more joy, more happiness, more security than you've ever experienced out there on the street. Like, this is a better life. And the kid would come into the community like, this is amazing. I love these people. Everybody's so nice and we're doing all this stuff. And then you'd go like, what do I have to believe to get in? And the answer was quite a bit. The only difference now is I still see the kid on the corner. And I still want to say to him like, dude, come join my community. Like we're loving each other. We're pursuing goodness. Like, this is a better life. And then when he comes in or she comes in and they love the community and they go like, what do I have to believe to get in? You go like, baby, nothing you don't have evidence for. Like, don't worry about it. Like, it's not about what you believe here. It's about what you value.
Bart Campolo, if people want more of you, either to hear you, see you, read you, talk to you.
Can't imagine why they would after,
how could
after
they
this
find
earnest
you?
Conversation.
If you've got more left in reserves than they want access.
Funny. I can't be clever.
You're
like
very
you
funny, because you still have all of the magnetism of a preacher, so to speak, right? Yeah, you just are talking about different things. So you're still doing it. You're still, you know.
And he would totally be played by Sam Rockwell in the movie version.
Yeah. It would be Sam Rockwell. Oh, I think absolutely. That's right. So how can people get more of you?
Well, I mean, I mentioned that documentary.
Yep.
And you can find that.
What's it called again?
It's called Leaving My Father's Faith. And you could find it at Campola Film. You could find it at bartcampola.org, which is my website. I mentioned that podcast, Humanize Me.
Yep.
You could find that anywhere you find podcasts, but you could also find it at bartcampola.org. Let's see, is there anything else?
If people want to talk to you, do you still do the coaching work?
I do. I do a lot of it. And I go to bartcampola.org.
All right.
And write to me.
Bart, thank you so much. This was like emotionally spirit. Right. I mean,
it was mind expanding.
Yeah.
It's like therapy.
Yeah.
It was mind expanding.
How much do we owe you?
Right. I mean, you came in and told a bunch of Jews that there are people who want community but don't believe in God. We've heard.
If only there were 200 more Jews sitting here listening to you talk right now.
So we've heard. Will you come back sometime, Bart?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Like, no.
No, I actually, it's funny, like, in all seriousness, like, and you can cut this out of the podcast, but like, I'm like.
I have a feeling we're not going to.
I would just like to start all, like, I feel like I just, I fell into like the worst evangelical Christian bad habit of talking too much. Like,
No.
Like, it's one of those things where I'm like, I just would like, I wish I could start over.
We know what we sound like.
We invited you here to interrupt you repeatedly.
I just really,
You know that there's been studies about, I think it's overlapping. I forget the linguistics term, that Jews interrupt more in conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
That is 100%.
Maybe I really am Jewish. Because that's what people complain about me all the time.
This is the last stage.
No. They're serious.
This is it. I'm on my way.
Not believing in God. Wanting community, wanting to interrupt people. Hello.
Bagels.
Went to Quaker College, went to Haverford.
Just
boom.
You're already on the Upper West Side, so you're basically there. Right.
Seder's in a week and a half. Just, right.
I'm ready.
Yep, you have enough time. Here's I'm going to get my yum.
Hey, have you noticed that every single podcast in the world, it seems, no matter how different they are, one thing they have in common is they ask you to rate them on iTunes? That's because a good iTunes rating bumps us up in visibility for other people. So it allows other people to discover this podcast. So here's, for example, a really good iTunes rating that we just got. It reads, I couldn't love this podcast more. I grew up being part of a modern Orthodox community, but I'm now a proud atheist Jew. I listen to this podcast religiously. Well, as religiously as any atheist can get. My coworkers have gotten used to me laughing out loud while listening. I highly recommend it along with the Facebook page, which makes you feel like part of a big family. Twin2855. Well, Twin2855, listen, send us an email at unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Give us your address and we will send you a free laptop sticker. For the rest of you, go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and say nice things like that and we will be super duper excited. If you want more Unorthodox, sign up for the newsletter by writing to unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Join the Facebook group, which is just always having these insanely funny conversations. Come see us live. We're doing a JCC show in July and I will be at Greenwich Reform Synagogue again on May 18th. That is a super spiritual, intellectual, loving, kind, supportive community for all your Reformed Jewish needs in Fairfield County. GRS is where you want to be. And if you want to wear Unorthodox on your body, on your person, go to bit.ly/unorthoshirt and find the latest in Unorthodox shirts, mugs, and stickers to put on yourself and surround your coffee with. And if you want even more of us, perhaps for the Passover season, we are doing our own Haggadah. Liel and Stephanie and I have put together this amazing Haggadah. It's free to download. It's a free downloadable PDF that you can download and then print out copies for all of your guests, all your company. So if you are one of those many, many Jews, and I think it's most of us, who feel like you've never found the perfect Haggadah, but you love the Unorthodox podcast, then maybe this is your Haggadah. So go to tabletmag.com/unorthodoxhaggadah Tuesday morning, tabletmag.com/unorthodoxhaggadah to download the first ever brand new Unorthodox Haggadah. Okay, one letter this week. Here it is. Dear Unorthodox, with all due respect to Rabbanit Sarna, which is really a tremendous amount of respect, the reason she gave for not watching Game of Thrones is wrong. If you shouldn't watch Game of Thrones, which you shouldn't, it should be because of the lazy writing. If we started insulating ourselves from nudity, violence, and bad values as if we were children, the Tanakh, Hebrew Bible, would be the first thing to go. Love and latkes, Gavriel Savit Woods.
Gavriel Savit Woods is like our public editor, like our peanut gallery. Yeah. He always gets the best.
Yeah. He keeps us honest. Liel, have you ever seen an episode of this show you refuse to watch?
I've seen the entire first season. And I disagree. And I wrote to Gabriel to say so. We had a very interesting discussion. Because this is what happens when you write to Unorthodox. You get emails frequently from two or three of us.
So why Tanakh, okay? Why Jewish Bible, okay, but not Game of Thrones?
It has to do with a covenant. It has to do with the intention. You know, the point isn't, you know, never tell stories or have sex and violence. The point is, if you're telling, it's like pornography, right? If you're telling a story with sex and violence just to titillate, hey, look, here's a naked prostitute and some violence, that's just kind of gross and icky. If you're telling a story that has these elements in order to transport, transform, transcend, that's beautiful and human.
It's like the Bible. I'll know it when I see it.
That's exactly right. I'm in season 5 of Game of Thrones in my binge watching over the last month. I will be back to you all with an opinion on this once I've gorged on the whole thing.
Oh, you need
the
whole oeuvre.
I have zero desire to watch Game of Thrones. I also miss, like, I miss seminal classes. I missed all of Mad Men, Breaking Bad, just like, just didn't watch
it. Were reading books and writing things.
No, I was watching
like
Gilmore Girls.
Oh, okay. If you want to send a letter.
Holds up, by the way.
If you want to send a letter, write to unorthodox@tabletmag.com or leave us a voicemail at 914-570-4869. Mazel tovs. Liel, do you have a mazel tov this week?
I sure do. What do like small town actors and actresses do when they get like really famous? Like, what's the first thing that you do?
Change their names.
Change
ditch
your name.
Everyone. Ditch your whole crowd.
Get your nose
ditch your
done.
Whole crowd, right? Yeah. Pretend like you're better because you're Hollywood. What does Gal Gadot do when she makes it big? Homegirl insisted on her $10 million Reebok advertising campaign that the photographer that shoot the campaign would be Duty, the unimprovably named Duty Hassan, the same photographer in Tel Aviv who discovered her 11 years ago before she was at all famous. And this is how you keep it real and loyal and wonderful.
That's amazing.
So Gal Gadot, we love you.
And Dudu, congratulations.
And Dudu, we love you endlessly.
It's Dudu. Dudu. Well, Dudu is his nickname. Dudu is his given name. Stephanie.
Dudu is his formal name.
That's right.
I like want to throw a hometown shout out to the entire Cross family who have really welcomed us in here. And to you and to all the kids who are here. We got Ellie. We got Lily, we got Hudson. I'm basically only here to hang out with the kids.
And Stella, Violet, and Miles.
Stella, Violet, Miles, yeah. Everyone's here until Lisa, who's here, and Debbie, who's not here, luckily, because we have overrun her house.
The Cross family is the second best studio on the island of Manhattan after Argo Studios. Bart Campolo, do you have a mazel tov this week?
I do. I have two, actually. I have a mazel tov to Rabbi Robert Barr, who is the person who introduced me to Mark in the first place, and he's a rabbi in Cincinnati, and he's just a lovely man. And so I just want him to get my mazel
tov. Is he running for Congress still?
He's not. He dropped out of the race. He got politically outmaneuvered by somebody else who had he did this really cool thing. He raised all this money. He was really going somewhere, and then the Democratic Party kind of stuck it to him.
As happens.
I know.
That's okay. And a second one?
Oh, and the second one is to my sister. And my brother-in-law, my sister Lisa, who married Mark Goodhart, a wonderful Jew, and so I love my sister so very much, and her husband, and they're up there in Boston being Jewish.
This Goodhart is the best last name.
Also, this is the point to note that you are Bart and your sister is Lisa.
Yes, Bart and Lisa.
Yes.
I'm going to hand off my mazel tov to listener Scott Altfeld, who wrote in and said, shout out to NYC JCC for letting many dozens of migrant farm workers and their allies shower while hundreds of us protested Wendy's board chairman, Nelson Peltz, parenthesis, international scumbag, soon to be valued partner when we win. Scott didn't add that the reason they're protesting Nelson Peltz is because he has refused as chairman of the board of Wendy's to sign Wendy's up for the Fair Food Program, which protects migrant and other farm workers' working conditions. Anyway, big ups to the people who let them all shower while they were here protesting international scumbag Nelson Peltz. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or leave us a voicemail at 914-570-4869. For merchandise, go to bit.ly/unorthoshirt. Follow Stephanie on Instagram at sputnik. Join our Facebook group. Our show is produced by Joshua Cross and Shira Talushkin with help from Julia Frakes. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our show is edited by Noah Levinson. Our music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Our Haggadah this year is edited by Liel Leibowitz with a little help from some other people, but look out for it. And write to us. Rabbinic supervision this week by Rabbi Major Reuben Livingstone of Her Majesty's Armed Forces. We recorded Argo Studios, but today at the Cross Family Home in Harlem, we're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.
Thanks for listening.
Wait. When I point at you, so we all start together. You ready? Everybody ready? Ready? See that finger?
Uh-huh. Thanks for listening.